John chapter 11, and we left off in verse 47. We've studied the resurrection of Lazarus from the dead. And this is still the backdrop as we come to this portion of chapter 11 and even into chapter 12, as we're going to see Lazarus at a meal there. And Jesus said, we know, he said, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die." And the wording again is never, ever die. And that's us, you guys. We got the relationship with Jesus. We're never going to die. You know, we're born once, you die twice. Born twice, you die once, right? So except for Lazarus, he died twice, you know, and then lived forever, right? So there's exceptions to the rule, but. And the question Jesus left Martha with there, of course, was, do you believe that? And that's the question for all of us. Do we believe that he is the resurrection and the life, and that if we trust in him, we will never die? Have we put our trust in Jesus Christ as the really important event? Now, the event of Lazarus being raised from the dead has again stirred the Jews against Jesus. So we begin our reading in verse 47. It says, "Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, 'What shall we do? For this man works many signs. And if we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation.'" They're sensing the need to do something, an urgency. Jesus' popularity is bothering them. And, a bit of a competition. They knew he had done these miracles. That's the interesting thing. We think sometimes, you know, with people that don't know the Lord, or even if you're a skeptic or you ever were a skeptic, you think, man, if I would just see a miracle, that would be it. I mean, you know, I would believe. Listen, I've seen people. I know people who have seen miracles and they don't believe. I mean, I have a friend of mine whose son was shot in the head right through his eye. It came out the side of his head over here and did not hit a major organ. Now, that kid was raised in a Christian home, was completely backslidden, and is still completely backslidden. And this happened about 5 or 6 years ago. He was shot in the head. It was a miracle. The doctors said it was a miracle. The nurses, everyone said it was a miracle. Pastors met with him, told him, this is a miracle. I saw him, said, "Hey, Jonathan, do you think this might have been a miracle?" He admits it. Yeah, I think it's a miracle. It's a miracle I'm alive. It's a miracle I wasn't paralyzed. It's a miracle. Is he walking with Jesus? Nope. Miracles do not necessarily do it. The Pharisees, the Jewish leaders, they knew there were miracles. They were aware. They had seen the guy who had been born blind, who was healed. They saw the lame man who walked and the man who had the withered hand have it be made whole again. Those things, they experienced all that stuff. But they didn't believe. Now Jesus has raised someone from the dead who's been dead for 4 days. This is the most radical miracle that there has been. This is the one, the most dramatic sign that he has done, and now they're really worried. Well, you know, I mean, healing a guy's arm or making a lame man walk or a blind man see, that's one thing. Now he's risen someone from the dead. Now, he'd already done that in the past, but it hadn't been as prominent as this. And the guy, you know, the other two hadn't been dead for 4 days. So they're worried about, they say, the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Probably thinking of the temple site. Maybe they would not allow them to use the temple site, close it down. But more importantly, these guys are concerned about their place or their position. They care more about their position and status than if Jesus might really be the Messiah. Isn't that amazing? And these are the religious guys. This is what happens sometimes when position becomes so important to a person. You'll do anything to keep it. You know, you get so into the prominence of a role or position. And this can even happen to some in ministry. You start serving in some capacity in ministry and you think the position is your right, or you should never have to consider giving it up or changing it. pardon me, all of a sudden, I'm having a problem. I'm allergic to you guys. I've seen where even ministry leaders, pastors, when it's clear that their time in ministry has run its course, and they hold on, and it just causes all kinds of issues and problems. These chief priests and Pharisees were concerned about their position, their lifestyle, their honor, and their place. That's what they were worried about. And what's interesting is that Jesus was no threat to that in a political sense. Jesus had no desire to take over their place. Jesus wasn't a political, didn't have any political aspirations of being a high priest, or he was already the highest of high priests. And what's also interesting is even though they think by killing Jesus they will save their nation falls anyway. In AD 70, Titus Vespasian comes in and destroys the city of Jerusalem, as Jesus predicted he would do. Verse 49, and one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for one man, for us, that one man should die. Notice he says it's expedient for us, that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish. Now, John then comments in verse 51. He says, now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Now, this is an amazing thing. Here is an ungodly, profane, evil high priest who prophesies that Jesus would die for the people. It's a true prophecy, right? It's real. Jesus did die for the people. It's true. That might seem kind of crazy to us. You know, why would God have a wicked high priest prophesy of the truth? But the point is that he's in the position of high priest. And in that role and position of high priest, God put upon him this prophecy. And it happens at other times in the Bible. King Saul prophesied, and he was a wicked king. You guys, you have to remember Balaam. He was the all-time most whacked-out prophet there ever was. I mean, Balaam was a prophet of God who tried to curse the children of Israel. And every time he would try to curse the children of Israel, blessings would come out of his mouth. And so, in his heart, I mean, he's cutting a deal with Balak on the side to get paid for cursing them, and he's not even able to do it. He's not able to fulfill his contract that he says he'll do. The key thing that John says, and he says this many years after the event, is that the prophecy was given in his capacity as high priest, the office. And Jesus does, in fact, die for the nation and for the sins of the whole world. You know, and it's an amazing thing when you consider what Jesus did for us in giving himself, dying for our sin. Of course, this week we are very much conscious of that, even more so perhaps than at other times. This being, of course, Holy Week, or the, you know, Passion Week, it's called, of course. And, you know, Good Friday, we'll be having the service to just commemorate and talk about the cross and what he did for us. And even looked at Sunday, how, you know, the whole issue of his supper, his last supper that he gave, that Passover meal that he desired so deeply to partake in before he suffered. You know, it's an amazing thing when you consider what he's done. He died to save us. He died to defend us. And the other thing that John comments on is that Jesus would not only die for the nation, but that he would gather a new nation, the true children of God, a new nation. He is referring here to forming of the church, which would be made up of Jew and Gentile, slave and free, male and female, all different kinds from all different places, you know. And again, you think of what it's going to be like around the throne of God with people from every nation, tribe, tongue, peoples, every kind of person standing there singing hallelujah chorus. It's going to be so wonderful. That's the church. Then, verse 53, from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. Therefore, Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there into the country near the wilderness to a city called Ephraim and remained with his disciples. So the Jews are now purposefully trying to kill Jesus. That's their goal. They've been on this for a while, but now it's gotten even more heated. It's more cranked up. They're more that much more after him. And Jesus then adjusts his direction in ministry at this point, and he changes his public outreach to a private inreach. He shifts his emphasis from signs to quiet, intimate conversations with his disciples, and he reduces his travels and returns to this area of Ephraim. He's not out evangelizing anymore. He's preparing to leave and preparing his disciples for his departure. And most of the rest of the book of John really will deal with that and then the death, burial, and resurrection. And now the Passover, the Jews, was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before Passover to purify themselves, and they sought Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple. What do you think? That he will not come to the feast? Now, both the chief priests and Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was, he should report it that they might seize him. They're looking for snitches. They're looking for somebody to turn Jesus in. And even though Jesus is not around, he's still the talk of the town. They're still speculating about whether or not he would come to the Passover feast in Jerusalem, whether he would indeed come to this Passover. And he would, of course, indeed come. We know that. And it would be the most significant in history, of course. Little did they know that it was the last Passover of significance and the first Lord's Supper that would soon come. So we finish John chapter 11. Great chapter on Lazarus and his resurrection and these final thoughts. But we come now to a story of Mary of Bethany, who pours out a very costly oil on the feet of Jesus and wipes this oil with her hair. Now, I want you to remember, this is not the same story from Luke chapter 7. There's another story of another woman in Luke chapter 7 who comes to Jesus and washes his feet with her hair. She weeps upon him. That story is a totally different story. That took place in Galilee. This takes place in Judea. It was a house of Simon the Pharisee. This is the house of Simon the leper. They're two different stories. And that story is only reported in that one place in Luke chapter 7, whereas this one is reported in Matthew, Luke, and John. And the house of Simon the leper here where they are is a place in Judea. And in the other story, the woman was a notorious sinner, we know, because Simon the Pharisee says, if Jesus knew who it was who's wiping his feet, who's washing his feet, you know, he would never let such a noted sinner do this. And Jesus, of course, rebukes Simon heavily in that story. And the interesting thing here as we look at this, we have a woman here in Mary, who's probably wealthy because she has this alabaster flask of oil. And we have this other woman who had worshiped Jesus. But both of them openly worship Jesus. They both openly pour out their love upon Jesus Christ. And they're both openly received by Jesus. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're a notorious sinner or whether you think you're a cleaned up sinner. And I say you think you're a cleaned up sinner because there's really no such thing until you come to Christ. The only way you're getting cleaned is by the blood of the Lamb. But it doesn't really matter how bad you've been. You know, some people have a radical testimony, right? Some people have a testimony where it's just, man, look where they came from. Can you believe it? And then others, you know, well, you know, I was raised in a Christian home. I got saved when I was 5 and I've walked with Jesus ever since. That's still a testimony. And you still are received in the same way. You're still received as worshiping the Lord Jesus Christ. And this notorious sinner, yes, she worshiped, but so did Mary, man. Mary had such a heart for worship. We're going to see that. Now, we come to this thing, and they have this meal, that they're going to come to. And we don't know how many people were there, but there seemed to be quite a few people. We know Jesus was there, right? We know the 12 were there, so that's 13. We know Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were there, so that's 15 people at this home. And it's the home of Simon the leper. And we assume that Simon the leper is Simon who used to be a leper, because if he was a leper and he was still a leper, you wouldn't go to his home, you know? And he would probably wouldn't even have a home. In fact, he'd be in a leper colony somewhere. So he's either Simon, who used to be a leper, or he's Simon. It's named Simon the leper's house because he died and he was a leper, but we don't really know the history. Some say, some of the church fathers have actually said Simon the leper was the father of Mary and Martha, and that's the house they went to. We don't know for sure. But we do know Simon the leper likely used to be a leper. He had been unclean. He'd been outcast, living in a leper colony again. Now he's looking into the eyes of the Lord who had cleansed him. We know that Lazarus is there. Imagine how he gazed at Jesus. You know, when you've been dead for a while and you come back, and you're sitting with Jesus, it's going to kind of affect you. People came to this feast to see Lazarus, we're told in the text. We're going to see that. He came just to check out. They came gawking at Lazarus. They wanted to check out Lazarus. Hey, did you hear about the dead guy? Let's go. Hey, we want to do an outing. Let's go see the dead guy. But he's not dead anymore. But he had been dead, you know. I remember there was a movie about that a number of years ago where there was a bunch of kids in this movie, and this guy came out of a tomb. And these kids ran down were running down the hallway. The dead guy, he's after us, you know. Imagine what that must have been like to go and see. I mean, listen, if somebody died and 4 days later rose from the dead, wouldn't you go to their house? I would. Wouldn't you go over and say, hey, can you tell me about being dead? I'd like to know what that was all about, you know? And people came to the feast to see Lazarus, and what's interesting about Lazarus, he didn't get caught up in the fame of it. You know, today, if somebody dies and comes back, they're writing a book 5 minutes later. You know, they're putting it out there, you know, I was dead for 90 minutes or whatever it is, you know. And he isn't into that. He's not into the book tour. He's not into any of that stuff. He's just into sitting at a meal with Jesus. That's all that Lazarus wants to do. And he understood something that nobody else, even at that meal, or anybody else understood. And that is, he understood something more about glory than anybody else did. Because he had been in paradise. He had been in Abraham's bosom. He was hanging out with Abraham and Moses and Elijah and Elisha. And, you know, he comes back and he probably starts telling Jesus all about, you know, who I met down there? It was amazing. And Jesus is probably saying, yeah, well, yeah, I kind of know. I've got a little clue of these things. I've been there, actually. We know Martha's there, Mary's there. Martha, you know, she's serving. We find her serving again, which is the way we always find her. But there's a difference between what we find in her serving here and when we find in the book of Luke the story of Mary and Martha where there's this dispute. Martha's no longer complaining. Martha had been complaining. You remember that story, how the two women were in the house and Mary's sitting at the feet of Jesus and Martha's doing all the cooking and cleaning and serving. And she says, Jesus, are you going to let her sit there and just sit at your feet and not help me out? Can't you see I'm busy here? And Jesus says to Martha, she's chosen the better part. She's chosen the better thing, to pour out her love to me. And, you know, Martha, I think, learned a lesson in this. She learned, well, I am, this is who I am. I'm a Martha. I'm a servant. I do this. But she's not griping anymore. She's no longer in this place where she's like, well, you know, nobody's doing anything but me, you know. By the way, there's another caution for you servants, for those of us who are servants. One of the things that can often happen to a servant is you start looking at everyone else and what they're not doing. Because after all, you are the super servant, you know. You do it all, man. You teach Sunday school. You go to the outreach. You do it all. And listen, that's great. You know, keep doing it. I'm not going to tell you not to serve. But keep your service in perspective and don't complain about somebody else. They're the Lord's servant. And God's the one that's got to inspire them to do what they need to do. You didn't need to worry about them. Remember what Jesus said to Peter when he was concerned about John And Jesus said to Peter, if I let this man live until I return, what is that to you? In other words, Peter, stop thinking about somebody else. Because, you know, Peter had just been restored, John chapter 21. He just gets restored back to Jesus, and he's immediately going, okay, so what about this guy? And it's so much our nature, isn't it? It's so easy for us to look at others and why aren't they doing this and why aren't they doing that and griping about everybody else. I know for me, when I start seeing that in me, I know my flesh is in a bad place. I can start to easily get critical and look at others and, you know, wow, man, those wicked sinners, why don't they get to work, you know, kind of thing, you know. Martha's not in that place at this point. She's not complaining. She's working. She's serving. And she's serving Jesus. She's heard that Jesus is the resurrection and the life. And she's seen Jesus do this miracle of raising her brother from the dead. She's so thrilled to even have a meal with her brother, you know. And she's working hard to give Jesus the best meal. I can imagine that Martha is just laying out the best tablecloth. She's fixing the table just perfectly. She's making a meal to die for. I mean, matzo ball soup. I mean, it, you know, you can imagine. Lamb chops. And just really working hard. And it is her act of worship. That's her act of worship, is to serve. That's her heart. Because, you know, there's all kinds of gifts, right? 1 Corinthians chapter 12, we're going to get there in another few weeks. But there's diversity of gifts, but the same Lord. Differences of ministries, but the same Lord. Same Spirit. Diversities of activities, but the same God who works all in all. It's all the Lord working in us, right? So we come to John chapter 12. Then, 6 days before Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus, who had been dead, I love that, who he had raised from the dead, there they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was the one who sat at the table. I do love the way he says, Lazarus, who had been dead, who had been raised, you know. Hey, the dead guy was here. And here he is. He's just hanging out with Jesus after he's dead, you know? That could even be a song that Lazarus could write, you know? You know, hanging out with Jesus after I was dead, you know, kind of thing. I don't know. Weird. I don't know. Sorry. But Martha, she's doing her servant thing. And then Mary, she took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. Nard or spikenard, the most expensive and rare perfume of that day. Red in color. And, you know, something that was so precious to Mary. I read about perfume today. I did a search on the most expensive perfume. You ladies might want to know about this. There is a bottle of perfume that's $215,000. I'm going to get that for my wife for the next Valentine's Day. But this perfume that Mary had, this was about a year's wages. Think of it maybe as in terms of $50,000 today, like a laborer's year's wages. And she's giving this to Jesus. Probably her most prized possession she owns. And it may well have been her dowry. That's what you would save, your most prized possession, if you're a woman. But she doesn't care. She's giving it to the one she loves the most anyway. And this is what we call extravagant worship. That's what this is. It's the willingness to pour out everything that's valuable to you to Jesus Christ. You know, David said, I will not give to the Lord that which costs me nothing. And sometimes we treat our service of the Lord or our worship to the Lord. And by the way, worship is more than sitting here and singing songs. Far more. In fact, Paul calls it a reasonable act of worship. in Romans chapter 12. Our reasonable service, he calls it. In fact, when you really think about it, it is a debt we owe. It is a duty we have to worship. How can we not worship him? When we think and you consider, I mean, you consider what he's done. How can we but worship him? And it's that willingness. And David said, I'm not going to give to the Lord that which costs me nothing. And I think some people at times, and Christians even, will just give to the Lord what they call worship. And it's just sort of a token, well, all right, I'll sing a song and lift my hand. I see these people doing it. All right, I can do that. All right. And it doesn't really mean anything. It's not just about public worship at all. But Mary here, she's oblivious. I don't think Mary cares or knows who's in the room except Jesus Christ. That's all that's on her heart. And worship needs to be sacrificial, and this worship is sacrificial to Mary. She takes this most prized cruse of oil, spikenard. Like Abraham, who, when he took Isaac to the mountain and was willing to sacrifice his only son at the altar because God had told him to do so. Do you know that's the first time the word worship is used in the Bible? It says that they went to that mountain and he said, we will go and worship. First time it's used. Mary would take this flask, this alabaster flask. We're told in the other Gospels it's an alabaster flask. And she would take it and she breaks it. These would come in a cruse where there would be a long neck and the only way to get it out would be to break the neck. And she would take that and she would pour it out upon Jesus' feet. It could never be closed up again. You know, it could never be contained because it was worship to Jesus. And she'd pour it on his feet and she'd wipe it with her hair. And even that was such an act of humility because a Jewish woman's hair, they weren't to let their hair down. The only one they would let their hair down was for their husband. And so there may have been some kind of like, whoa, what's she doing in the crowd? But the humility of this, she's at the feet of Jesus, sitting there, pouring this out on him. And we seem to always find Mary, every time we read of her, she's sitting at the feet of Jesus. Again, that story of Mary and Martha, that's what she was doing in Luke chapter 10, where she's sitting at the feet of Jesus, worshiping Jesus, listening to Jesus, pouring out her heart to Jesus. Then, of course, in John chapter 11, in the very story we read last week, when Mary is called for by the Lord, when the master calls for her, what does she do? She goes out, and when she sees him, she falls down at his feet, worshiping him. Mary was a worshiper. She was a radical worshiper. And here she worshiped him in her gift, in her humility. And it's interesting because, you know, we never see this Mary, at least no record of her, at the cross or at the tomb. You kind of wonder, you know, why don't we see her in any of those places? Maybe it's because she got it. She understood, first of all, she understood at this point where Jesus was going. She already knew he was dying. She didn't have to go to the cross. She didn't have to go to the tomb. And I think she understood resurrection life. Listen, when your brother's been raised from the dead, you start to get the hint. And we know that the resurrection of Lazarus was a foreshadowing for Jesus. It only happened just a short time, a month or so before he would himself go to the cross and die and be resurrected 3 days later. We never see her there. Maybe she's already on resurrection ground. She already gets it. And it says then that the fragrance of that costly spikenard of oil filled the house. You know? You know, we have a fragrance about us. The fragrance of worship is what she had. She had the fragrance of worship that affected the whole place. And when we are in an attitude and a heart of worship in our lives, do you know you're going to impact people? You're going to have a fragrance about you. In fact, Paul says in 2 Corinthians, he says, thanks be to God who leads us in triumph in Christ, through us diffuses the fragrance of his knowledge in every place. For we are to God the fragrance of Christ among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. To the one we're the aroma of death leading to death, and to the other the aroma of life leading to life. And who is sufficient for such things? There's an aroma to this home. And the question that I would pose to us tonight, what is the aroma of your life? What's the aroma of your home? Is that aroma something that you can be glad of? It's worship, it's praise, it's you know, you have plaques on your wall, you have things that point to Jesus, you know, you don't have, you know, pornography coming into your house. Or do you have an aroma that the Lord would be disappointed with? The aroma of bitterness, perhaps. The aroma of anger. The aroma of argumentative attitudes toward one another. You know, Satan wants to disrupt your life. Do you know that? That's his whole MO. And he will try to divide husbands and wives. He will get in there. And you ever notice if you're married, you got a husband, you got a wife, and you're trying to communicate, and how it just will twist so easily? That's the enemy trying to do that. You need to recognize it. You need to see, you know, your wife is not your enemy. Your husband is not your enemy. And you need to look at it like and realize they have your good in mind. And if you'll listen to them and then try to, oh, you know, my wife and I have kind of a thing like, okay, here's what I think you said. And then she said, oh, no. This is what I said. Okay, so this is what you said. So you didn't mean this. No, I didn't mean that. I meant this. Okay, you meant that. Oh, good. Now, we don't always do that. Sometimes we do, yeah, 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 yeah. You know? Well, she does. I mean, you know. But there are, you know, there is that, and what aroma, you know. Would people come to your home and go, man, this place kind of stinks? Or do you have that aroma of a Christian attitude in your home? An aroma of worship where there's been a pouring out at the feet of Jesus. We need to have that aroma in our homes, in our lives. It needs to permeate our lives. It's what the Lord has changed us. He's come into our life. If you're really a Christian, if he's really in your life, you know, you need to learn words like, please forgive me, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. How about this one, guys? You're right, honey. That one hits home a little bit, right? I was mistaken. No, I mean, we need to admit these things. And it comes down to laying down our pride. And it's not just married relationships, it's all relationships. And it's not just, you know, in our homes, but it's in our workplace. It's everywhere. We should seek to be the aroma of life, the aroma of worship, the aroma of Jesus in every place we are. We need to realize, you know, when something goes wrong with us, you know, you have something you're having done, and you're going to a place, maybe you need something done. You need tires put on your car, like I did last week. You need to realize that every person you interact with, God has put you in their life. You know, God's put you there to be an aroma of Jesus. So negotiating your tire deal and doing it in a godly manner is really important. You don't grind the guy. You don't get on there, you know, you cheapskate, why don't you give me a better deal, you know, kind of thing. Because then he sees your fish on the back of the car. And he's like, what are you doing, man? See, we're an aroma all the time. And, you know, there's a purpose that she's connected to within this worship. There's something that she's going to accomplish. Jesus is going to define this. He goes on, it says, but one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? Poor Judas is who he's asking about. This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief. That word is klepto. We know what it is, right? Kleptomaniac. And had the money box, and he used to take what was put in it. Now, by the way, there's an aside in this that I've always been fascinated by. Jesus cared so much about money that he put Judas in charge of the money box. I mean, think about that for a minute. You know, this is what Jesus' view of money is. We get so hung up with money. Jesus' view of money is, you know what? I can get lots more of that. You take care of it. I don't even care. Oh, and I know you're pocketing it. I got you down. You know, he knew. He knew what Judas was. And he put him in charge of the money box. But Judas is starting to think more like a corporate exec than he is a disciple. Maybe he always thought that way. His concern is for, he says, the poor and his poor empty pockets. John, interesting, he's looking back, of course, and commenting on this years later as he writes this gospel. And, you know, one thing we know, when you worship and serve extravagantly, listen to this, folks, you will be criticized. Always. The hard thing is when the criticism comes from another disciple. And sometimes that's where it comes from. Now, by the way, don't get in the habit of pointing to the other disciple and going, you're a Judas. You know, be careful with that. By the way, it says the other disciples, the other gospels say the other disciples chimed in. They were like agreeing with Judas. They're like, yeah, what's up with that? You know, Judas is probably saying something like, you just poured $1,000 on the floor or thousands of dollars on the floor. What are you doing? Don't you realize how much that stuff is worth? Don't you realize what we could have done with that? We could have sent missionaries all over the world. Man, we could have given so much food to the poor. We could have fed thousands with this. And it sounds noble. It sounds good. It sounds spiritual, doesn't it? But Jesus didn't think so. Look what he says. Let her alone. Now, you always kind of wonder how he said that, right? Did he go, let her alone, Judas, you know? But we know he's talking to all of them. But he says, she has kept this for the day of my burial. For the poor you will have with you always, but me you do not always have or have always. That's the purpose. The purpose that we mentioned earlier is Jesus said this was done for his burial. You see, Mary, she was unique. She uniquely understood and knew that Jesus was going to the cross. And then it was coming soon. And she saw this. This is it in her heart. This is my opportunity. This is my chance to show my love, to pour out everything that I've got in my heart for Jesus Christ. This is it. She may not have realized this is why she saved this expensive perfume. She may, again, have been saving it for her own wedding. But she knows now, as she's sitting at Jesus' feet, as she sees Jesus, as he's risen, as his brother, her brother has risen from the dead, and Jesus was there, and Jesus delivered as he always has. And she loves him so much at this point. She's like, I'm going to give this lavish gift to him for his burial. Unique opportunity. He rebukes Judas. He rebukes the other disciples. And he says, you'll always have the poor with you. And this is true, by the way. We will always have poor people with us. Now, that does not mean we're supposed to ignore the poor. That's not what Jesus is saying. The opportunity to serve the poor is before us every single day of our lives. That will always be. And let me say, you know, it has been proven. Socialism, communism, capitalism, doesn't matter what kind of ism there is poor people. There always are poor people, and there always will be poor people. Obamanomics, whatever you call it, will not solve the problem of the poor. There will always be poor. There'll always be needs. There'll always be things that will draw our attention away from worship. And we need to do those things, but we need to worship first. Jesus puts the priority on worship, because you know what? If you're not worshiping the Lord, what you're doing for the Lord is really just a benevolent act. You might as well join the Elks Club or some other club. And here's the thing that's really striking when you think of this. There are times when certain things, you only get one opportunity to do them. This was Mary's opportunity to worship Jesus in this manner. She was not going to have him very much longer. He was leaving this earth. She knew it. And there are opportunities to worship and serve people that only come along once in a while. And I notice this with times when the Lord's prompting me to go visit someone in the hospital. And I get busy and I maybe miss the window. And that's happened to me. And I felt really bad as a pastor and gone, oh no. And I'm trying really hard to never let that happen again. To never allow a time when you know, if God's saying, prompting me, go see this person. Go pray for this person. To be available to do that. Because that may be the only window I have into their hearts and into their lives in that way. You may have that same thing, an opportunity to minister to someone, and the Lord's prompting you. Maybe you feel funny and you don't want to do it. Look, do it. Take that opportunity. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. And Mary was so sensitive to the moment before her and where Jesus was heading. She took her opportunity to pour out the spikenard. How about us? Have we taken our opportunity to pour out the spikenard? You know, Martha's spikenard was serving Jesus. All of us has different forms of spikenard, so to speak, different things that are so valuable to us. She took her opportunity to pour it out. We will have Christian duties to do all the time. We will have poor people. They'll always be there. But how can we not pour out our hearts on the altar of worship? There's no greater thing than to worship him. Look for those moments. Look for those opportunities. You know, and I think of old Apostle John here, 90s, in his 90 years old, he's writing this. He's thinking of all the people at this meal. And he too, I'm sure, is remembering what it was like to watch Mary do this and the whole experience. And they've almost for sure all gone ahead of him. You know, Lazarus, he died again. Mary, Martha, all gone. Peter, his friend, crucified upside down. John was still alive, and he only has one person, in a sense, to relate this whole thing to, and that's Jesus himself. And he's still sitting with Jesus. And I'm sure as he's retelling this story, he's saying, "Is it okay to write this? What do you think about this, Jesus?" You know? Now, a great many of the Jews knew that he was there. And they came not for Jesus' sake only, but they might also see Lazarus, who had been raised from the dead. You know, Lazarus is like a sideshow now. But the chief priests plotted to put Lazarus to death. You know, you're really not on good ground when you've died once already and you got people trying to kill you. That's like this guy can't get a break, you know. Of course, he's really maybe in the place where it's like, it's okay, kill me again because I was in a better place anyway. I really liked it, you know. And they wanted to kill him because on account of him, many of the Jews went away and believed in Jesus. Lazarus' life, he didn't have to say anything. All he's got to do is say, "My name is Lazarus. Okay, I believe in Jesus." You know, what a witness, right? Lazarus is being a witness without even doing anything. It's because he's literally living the resurrected life. Do you realize that when you live the resurrected life of Christ, your life is just a witness automatically? When you live that life, and that's what Lazarus is doing. The next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. So word gets out that he's going to the Passover. We know that he sent two disciples ahead of him to the Passover. And we'll just read this last section and we'll cover more of it next time. But since it is Passover week and since we just looked a little bit at the triumphal entry on Sunday, we'll just read through it so we, you know, kind of just get that sense again of what took place. We know that he sends two disciples to go find this colt. And they took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him and cried out, "Hosanna," which means save now. So they're looking for Jesus to save them right now and be their Messiah, overthrow the Romans. "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel." Then Jesus, when he had found a donkey, sat on it. As it is written, "Fear not, daughter of Zion. Behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt." His triumphal entry. Again, we'll look at more detail. His disciples did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written about him and that they had done these things to him. Therefore, the people who were with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb, raised him up from the dead, bore witness. So, you know, Lazarus, they're getting some mileage out of Lazarus raising from the dead. He's being a great witness because of that resurrection life. And for this reason, the people also met him because they heard that he had done this sign. The Pharisees therefore said among themselves, "You see that you are accomplishing nothing. Look, the world has gone after him." People are interested in Jesus because of the signs of the resurrection. I pray that's true now, don't you? I pray that happens this week on Easter Sunday, that every church in this area is busting out with people. Every church that preaches the gospel will have people standing there and coming to Christ this Sunday. But you know, I can't, as I look at this, the lessons of this chapter are amazing, aren't they? Mary's worship was a costly worship. It was an act of humility. It was a fragrance of the worship. She gave it all. It had purpose. She took her opportunity. She took that moment. And she poured out her heart to Jesus Christ and worshiped him. A beautiful picture. The fragrance of the oil. You know, you wonder how long did she leave that oil on her hair? Maybe days, maybe weeks. You know, I'm not washing this off, man. This is the fragrance I had in the moment I sat at the feet of Jesus. Let's worship him, man. Let's have the team come and pray.